Producing a weekly podcast on food and farming, I feel very fortunate to live close to the top-rated agricultural university and the World Food Center at UC Davis. Well, there's a new podcast at UC Davis, and it's called Unfold. It takes a look at complicated problems and discusses solutions with experts. And this season, they have been focusing on sustainably feeding a growing population. Host Amy Quinton and Alexa Renee examine the debate over switching to plant-based diets, GMOs, and gene-edited food, food waste, and the politics of food. It's fun and interesting listen, and you can find it wherever you find podcasts and probably where you found my podcast on Farm to Table Talk.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
And if you listen to Farm to Table Talk, then you're one of those people that's curious about what's happening in the food movement. And it means a lot of different things. It means that we are marketing products locally, regionally, still have some marketed the way it always has been. Well, I'm really happy today to have someone help us with that conversation of what's going on. And my guest is Dr. Kristen Kiesel. And Kristen is with UC Davis. She wrote a paper that really got my attention called New Marketing Opportunities for Local Food Producers. Kristen, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you.
Kristen, I'm curious. You have a lot of ways you can use your time and your expertise, and you teach courses on marketing. What drew you to this subject, to being able to study and put this report together about marketing opportunities for local food producers?
Yes, I should probably start with this is a little bit of a progress report. This is an ongoing research, and it fits in my overall research interests that are really around better understanding consumer preferences, but also better understanding how these preferences are formed. And I'm particularly interested in preferences for what in the food area is often called value-added foods. The idea that we are developing preferences for food attributes that we might not be able to experience, and we rely on information. And how do we develop those preferences? So for value-added foods, those are things like production attributes. It could be things like nutrition characteristics. It could be things like genetically modification. They are all in my research interest in the bigger context of promoting healthier and more sustainable food choices, and also looking at the role of policy can play in those decisions. And again, a really heavy emphasis on focus on information provision, which has then an overlap to marketing and labeling. So I've done quite a bit of work on organic certification. I've done work on nutrition labeling. And consumer interest for local foods is one, I would say, probably one of the newest trends of those food movements, and a trend that isn't very well understood. And that really made me very curious in this context.
You know, in approaching this subject, you mentioned that I think you're from Germany originally.
And yes, that's correct.
You have a nice accent. I love the accent, and we're getting some of it today in a conversation. And the reason I point that out is I remember a time I went to a conference at Purdue, and that there was some large food companies, and maybe it was General Mills or someone, that was, you kept looking down the road, and at that time, they were starting in Europe. At that time, they were looking for trends they thought were going to be coming here, and so they would look to Scandinavia, Germany for environmental concerns. Here, we talk about California used to have a reputation for leading, but again, there, they were trying to go even further back and see these trends starting in Europe, and eventually they would be here in the States. Is it your experience that that's been the case, that many of these areas have started in Europe and then are expressing themselves here in the United States?
That is quite a large question. I guess what I can say is when I started studying, I actually started studying in Germany. And some of my curiosity about better understanding preferences and how preferences are formed came from the observed differences in the way we approach eating in Europe and then coming to the US and seeing some of the different culture and different ways of engaging with your food. In some of my earlier career as a student, that was where some of my curiosity came from to a certain extent. And I don't necessarily think that there are significant differences or one region influences always the other. I think it's a constant back and forth, and there's also a lot of similarities. So I'm not sure that I would be comfortable saying that it comes one way or the other, but food is such a powerful way of engaging with culture, of engaging with emotions, that it's just such a complex choice that we quite frankly don't understand quite as well as we would like to.
Well, it's interesting, too, because we're UC Davis, which is recognized, as many people accept the fact that it's the number one school in agriculture and looking at food issues, and you're in an area which is great for food production, certainly. And so when you look at that world now from where you sit at UC Davis and want to start kind of evaluating what's going on in the stores, what's going on with consumer demand, again, how did you frame this? You mentioned that the article I saw was something that is a part of a larger project. You've got other things and elements on it. But bring us back to the beginning that you were saying, okay, this is a blank slate right now, and I'm going to try to fill it in. We're going to look at what's happening. How did you frame that? How did you decide that we're going to make this inquiry?
It starts with this idea that you have, on the one hand, this heightened growing consumer interest in local foods, and on the other hand, quite a bit of interest on the regulation as well as on the food production in local food systems and more sustainable production practices. And then if you look at local foods, there just seem to be a number of opportunities in terms of aligning the consumer interest, what the consumer wants, better informing the consumer about food production, but also creating opportunities for small and local food producers, both on the farm side as well as on the entrepreneur side. And then also having this aspect of connecting potentially urban as well as rural consumers. So local was just this incredibly complex area to study that had so many opportunities, but yet there wasn't a clear handle on any of those angles. So we have funding opportunities. We have an opportunity to get young people excited about agriculture. We have an opportunity to give the consumer what they want. But we don't very well define or understand what exactly it is consumers are looking for when they say they prefer local food. And then we also need to better understand supply chain relationships so that the consumer then actually does buy or is able to buy what they're looking for, and that they are supporting small local producers rather than reinforcing some of the market power structures we see in the food markets.
Have you done any studies, just consumer studies, perhaps here at UC Davis, where it's confirming that, local food or understanding how food is produced is a priority for the consumers?
So we have done our own surveys for my area of local foods. We work in collaboration with the Davis Food Co-op as well as the Sacramento Food Co-op. And on the consumer side, what we really want to do is try to get a better understanding of what we call stated preference, but then also link it to revealed preference. So the idea that you as a consumer have a really strong idea of what you want to buy, but then we also want to see what you do choose in the actual purchase situation. And what we find in the research overall, not just for local, that there are usually quite some differences in stated preference and then revealed preferences. And so that sometimes means that there is a large potential, but then other consideration like price and availability and taste to a certain extent make consumers buy something different that they state they would be wanting or willing to buy. So that was the understanding that we wanted on the consumer side, really narrowing down what is it consumers are asking for when they say they have a preference for local food. What is it that they're after? And so our work, as well as work in other areas and mostly consumer surveys, indicate that the consumer awareness for local is actually the highest awareness compared to a number of other food production considerations, including genetic modification, including organic. So again, highlighting a really large potential for promoting local foods. But then when you dig down, it's going to be a lot harder in terms of what do consumers understand are the key considerations for local.
So what have you learned? You mentioned you were working with the co-op in Davis, and we should explain what those are, too. I mean, that's maybe not everyone that's listening has a cooperative store. Mm-hmm. They do tend to be, a lot of times they're organic, a little bit more health conscious in some respects. How would you explain a co-op store to somebody that's used to just shopping at a supermarket chain?
Mm-hmm. Well, a co-op store is a store that is organized slightly different than a regular supermarket. So it is a business structure, and the business structure is such that the consumers can be members of the store. And so in that sense, they are also owners and are involved in the decisions that store makes. Most co-ops, you can shop whether you're a member or not. But again, the important part is that you are an owner of that business. And so you're involved in those decisions. The assortment, as you mentioned, it is a specialized grocery store, and each co-op can then make a decision whether they are exclusively, for instance, selling organically produced products or whether they are selling both organically produced and conventional products. So you as a consumer, if you become a member and you get your membership share, get to weigh in on some of those decisions, from product assortment to store design, anything that you can think of. So you're more involved and more part of that grocery store than you would in a traditional grocery store.
Well, I'm sure that traditional grocery stores are responding to what they think the market is signals are. So I'm sure that they have that opportunity to be able to say, well, people are buying this, so apparently they want it, and maybe we need to get more of this and less of that because we're getting that signal from what we're putting on the shelves. But it does make sense that, as you've explained, the co-ops, that's added a dimension too, where they're really even more vested into the store, and they have another level of communication of what they like to see in the store rather than just what gets rung up at the cash register.
Mm-hmm. I guess the way I would frame it is, if we look at the food market, the retail market in general, the two big trends we see is increased differentiation and to increase concentration. And that makes it a lot harder for these independent retailers like the co-ops to define themselves. Food co-ops traditionally are defined as really engaged with their community, partly because through those memberships. But now that we have all these other specialty stores, so traditionally, for instance, food co-ops is where a lot of the organic movement developed, and the idea of organics that was really driven by food co-ops. Now, as we know, you can buy organic anywhere, from Costco to Walmart to all of the different stores, and they are competing with the prices. And so they need to continuously redefine the added value they have for their members to shop at their store. And consumers' concern about local products is one of the ways in which they can potentially directly tap into what happens in their community and also satisfy the demands of their members. So our idea working with the food co-ops was that consumer interest should be even more pronounced in the food co-ops than it potentially is in some of the other more traditional grocery stores. And so in terms of better understanding consumer preferences, it gave us more data potentially to work with.
Did you get to see data? I'm sure you went to the stores, and I'm sure you talked to the people at the stores, maybe even did some consumer intercepts and get their opinions. But could they show you, say that here's this product that's identified locally and here's a product that's not? And
yeah, so let me maybe back up there a little bit. So mm-hmm. both of the food co-ops that we work with have an official definition of local. And most of the definitions we see for local, although local products are not clearly defined, which is the hard part of analyzing local food sales and local food preference, most of the definitions we see are based on mileage. And so both of the food co-ops we worked with have a definition of local foods based on mileage. In one case, 200 miles, and in one case, 100 miles. Radius around their store. If you look at the farm bill, the first definition of local was based on potentially up to a 400-mile radius. Sometimes you see local defined as coming from the state in which you shop. There's a lot of different definitions. But most of the definitions we see are based on distances and transportation distances, which link it back to environmental considerations. So when we worked with the stores, we again did two things. We created and then also sent out our own survey to provide information to the stores and also for us to better understand, are consumers aware of these definitions? Are they aware of some of the promotional efforts at the store? And then also, are they aware at the promotional efforts of the food producers? We linked it to just labeling that you see from the brands itself, from the producers itself. And then we added a second area is what could the store do to promote some of those. And that is something that we are following up, and we now have the data. We did a label experiment. So we help evaluate for both of those stores what would be the impact of highlighting local labels on the shelf. So at the end of the day, we have information on stated preferences, and then we have also information on revealed preferences, so the actual purchase decisions of the consumers, and revealed preference in two areas of analysis. The first one based on what the products themselves promote on the packages, and then the second area if the store goes in and posts the labels on the shelf.
Are they consistent? Are you seeing that it's closely aligned to what people say that their priorities are, and the purchases match up with their expressed interest?
So they're not necessarily consistent. So in our first level of analysis, what we find, if you don't have a promotion at the store level, so if you rely on what the brands, the products individually promote on their packages, we don't see a lot of differences in price or higher purchasing probabilities for those local foods. So that seems to suggest, although consumers have a strong interest in those products, they might not be able to identify or find them in the store without any additional promotional efforts. So that's the first aspect. And here we really were less interested in produce, but we really wanted to look at some of the processed foods, linking it to some of the cottage food regulations, for instance, that we see in Sacramento, and linking it to the idea of what are some of the opportunities for local food producers to enter those markets.
Because there are more and more farmers markets are getting locally processed, and they're taking advantage of the cottage industry rules And it's, and I'm hearing from people all over the United States, certainly, that are doing that. And especially in areas that have less of a growing season than California, which is almost everywhere has less of a growing season than we do in California.
Yes, that's correct.
So that they can do preserve products or a little preparation, a little processing with salsas and soups and breads and sorts of things. And we're seeing that some of those that get started now in farmers markets evolve to where they're putting a product on the shelf in stores. And there's been a few cases of bakeries I know that they actually created bricks and mortar, that they started, you know, working in their own kitchen, and they've gone to farmers markets and they've gone to CSAs, and now they have a store of their own, or they've got products on the shelf. So that does bring in something different, doesn't it? Because you could see that the freshness idea maybe would appeal to people if they're looking for local, if it's literally fresh. But I don't know why that wouldn't really help any if it's a jar of soup or salsa or bone broth or something like that.
Mm-hmm. You're hitting on a lot of interesting points in what you just explained. The first being, we focused on process as not only as a way, as you say, to extend seasons, but you also see that in processed foods, you have more opportunities for branding. So when we talk about produce, we often talk about commodities. And so there's not a lot of branding differences and market power for the producers to really promote their products. So when you go to a processed food product, you have the opportunity to brand and label your product, to provide some information to the consumer. So the margins are slightly higher for those products, and it might make some of the farmers more competitive. It might also extend the seasons. The other aspect that you brought up is going back to what consumers are looking for when they look for local. And so we did some of that, tested that in our survey responses. And again, in other research, you find it as well. And what we find, and that is an important point that we are trying to make in this article that you mentioned, that consumers might not primarily focus on transportation or food miles. That might not be their primary consideration. We use a concept from behavioral economics that talks about confirmation bias and availability heuristics, that despite getting new information, in this case, getting information about the actual definition of what a local product is in this setting, you come in with your own ideas. And so it seems to be the case that considerations for local are not primarily the distance, but they focus on ideas of freshness, they focus on ideas of small production. A lot of consumers view local also as a way of naturally producing or organically producing the product. They tend to think of local as an indication for higher quality. So it's a very complex idea that consumers bring to the idea of local foods and why they would prefer local foods. And the other really important aspects that is really interesting with local, that is very different than what we see, for instance, with organic foods, is that preference for local seems to spread across all of the different income categories. So usually when we think about organic or some of these other value added, we see a higher interest or a higher willingness to pay for higher income consumers. But local has this really interesting aspect of giving back to your community, or a sense of belonging, or a sense of supporting people that you know. And so we see that it is a really important concept across all of the different income groups, and potentially even more pronounced for some of the consumers that tend to be in the middle or lower income groups. And that is something that came out of a Nielsen study, not so much.
You know, I wonder how much just plain trust enters into it. Again, when you think of local, maybe you think of whether it's fresh, whether it's food miles and so forth. And when you get into the question of quality, they might think of, well, I know people around here are going to be doing the right thing. I'm not so sure if it's coming from the other side of the world, whether they have the same rules and regulations that we do. So I wonder if trust isn't pervasive in the attitude too.
I think trust is a real big component, or authenticity, in the statements and in the relationships you build. The way I view marketing opportunities for local in this ongoing research and what I've learned, I really think marketing local is for first and foremost relationship marketing. So what consumers are looking for is a connection, a relationship with their food, knowing where their food is coming from, who produced their food, and also through that really a sense of community. And so trust is a really important aspect there, right? As we see so many considerations in our food, from production to safety to all kinds of those issues. It goes back to the idea that if they think it's a local food, then they potentially want that relationship with the producer, and that induces or gives them that trust.
I wonder, though, if it also suggests that the farmer could really screw it up if they don't have trust locally. This reminds me of, I've heard years ago, the story that back in the Midwest, where one town might manufacture Chevrolets and the other town manufactured Fords. And they used to say there was a period where the Fords were always the top-selling car in the Chevrolet factory town, and vice versa, that in the Ford manufacturing town, Chevrolets were the top-selling cars, because there were some bad feelings maybe they passed. That people, rather than just supporting the hometown, they thought, man, I know how some of these things are going on. And, you know, it expressed itself in their purchases. So if there's a halo on local, then it must be a lot of pressure on those farmers to keep up that halo. Maybe that's why they donate food to different events and show up for the bridge dinners and stuff like that.
Yes, I mean, I think your idea of having a halo is definitely the right one. So there's this idea of, again, like local can produce value added to the consumer. The aspect that I find really interesting is, depending on how we define local, it either opens up the opportunity for some of the relatively large producers that fit that definition and might be able to use that promotion for their products, but that might not be exactly what the consumer wants. And that might also keep some of the smaller and more regional producers out of that market and don't give them access to the same opportunities. So the angle we were focusing on, not so much on whether it is a risk, is that the small and regional producers have what the consumer is looking for. And now it's really more of a communication and marketing challenge in allowing the producers, the local producers, especially small and medium-sized businesses, access to those markets, to those relatively concentrated markets, and figuring out where the barriers to entry are and how we can help those small and local producers overcome economies of scale in terms of promoting and marketing their products. And you mentioned farmers markets. So a lot of the local production is actually direct to consumer sales. It goes through farmers market. But we see that these marketing channels are saturated a little bit, and there's not as many growing opportunities. And it comes as relatively high cost for these small producers in terms of their time costs and so on. And the idea is to then also bring, as you mentioned before, some of these producers into the regular retail stores. And local right now is a marketing strategy that we don't just see in the food co-ops, we see them across all of the big retailers, and really trying to get a better understanding and balancing that as a food trend.
Which means they're reinforcing what you found. It works, because when almost every manufacturer now of some food product has some explanation of where the raw materials were grown and how they were produced, and I eat too many of a certain kind of cracker, and I'm always, the whole back panel is all of the wheat farmers that are producing for that cracker. I read the whole story, though, or you know me, buy granola too, and I find myself doing that. And you know that as a marketing expert yourself, that real estate is expensive for people to use up labels and boxes and packages. since they're putting, giving that space for these stories, they're convinced that it helps. It's an important marketing tool.
Yes, so there is a great marketing potential when it comes to local. And maybe let me put it a little bit in a context and step back here a little bit and add a little bit of economics to it to give a context. So with a term like local and with some of the trust issues you mentioned, the issue is that local is what we would call in economics a credence attribute. So we can think about attributes at three levels. We have a search attribute, something that you can fully resolve your uncertainty before you make a purchase, for instance, a product price. Then we have an experience attribute when it comes to food. So that's something that you get to experience after you purchase, something like taste. And then we have these attributes that we call credence attributes that you essentially never really get to resolve your uncertainty, and you have to use the word of the producer, for instance. The producer will tell you it's produced organically. You can't really test that. A lot of the GMO modification, we have some tests, but the levels are not that you can test it. And so when it comes to credence attributes, and a lot of these value-added attributes are credence attributes, it gives a lot of marketing opportunities because, again, we know consumers want these complex attributes, but it also leaves a lot of room in how to communicate and market them. And so there's, on the one hand, of course, the opportunities that the producers and retailers seek, but it creates issues of access, right? So in terms of market concentration and are these labels potentially somewhat misleading? Who can most credibly communicate those stories? How are you going to communicate it? How do you use it as a food co-op or at a small producer to tell your consumer that you have the product they want?
I'm thinking that we're talking about retail and farmers. We could have pulled restaurants into this too, because restaurants, even large restaurant chains even, but certainly some of the farm-to-fork restaurants, draw attention to the farms. Although, you know, I was just at one this weekend that's one of my favorites. They don't mention the names of the farms, but you just know. You know, it's kind of, you go to that restaurant, everything about them suggests that they know who's growing their product, and you don't even think to ask them the question because you believe in them.
Yes.
Now, when we come back to this then, is your, what you've seen so far, is your counsel to farmers to push to have their products identified as locally produced to the extent that they're delivering to co-ops and others? Is that the direction they should go? Or you raise some questions that in some cases that a region or identifying with the specialty mm-hmm. of a region might even be preferred?
Yes, so two aspects. The one aspect that you mentioned with restaurants, the trend of local we see in restaurants even more so. We have a couple of trends that are considered hyper-local in restaurants, where some of the restaurants now growing their own food sure. on site. But restaurants, and we make it actually broader, institutions can actually be powerful intermediaries to inform consumers about where their food is coming from. So it's a trend in retail, but as well in any kind of purchases that would go under the area on consuming food away from home. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. In terms of going back to recommendations to local farmers or local producers, the way that we approached it is really, again, how can local farmers and local producers access these markets, this really strong growing consumer trend? And our recommendation is essentially that each individual producer might not have the means to do all the promotion, to do the marketing themselves. So we are looking on trying to identify how they can cooperate with other producers, how they can create some economies from scale. And so that's where you mentioned that we are talking about regional brands. So this is something we can learn from Europe, for instance. Europe has these regional indicators. And so
one thing or one recommendation that we have for regions that are really looking at food systems, local food systems, is not so much to focus on the definition of miles, but trying to create strong regional brands that then allow farmers access to those brands and allowing them to market their products under a strong regional brand, both in this region, but potentially also across region.
Would an example of that be, say, like in Cincinnati? Somebody might have a small farm outside of Cincinnati, but perhaps they should, that is providing different produce, certainly seasonal, mm-hmm. I mean, some other things that not seasonal. And should they look at, like, Ohio River Valley, which could include northern Kentucky and southern Ohio and parts of Indiana, and go together to try to create more of a visibility of a group of farmers marketing rather than just Jane Smith and her produce identifying?
Yes, that's the right direction. Let me give you an example that is an example here from California and relates to two of the projects we were working on. One important aspect is that we find that this preference for local, or at least the willingness to pay for local, is a lot more pronounced in urban settings. So the idea of farm to fork is something that you find quite a bit more in urban settings. So very pronounced in the Bay Area, for instance, to a certain extent in Sacramento. But what does the local food movement mean for more rural settings and farmer communities? So we worked with two regional projects that are both supported by a nonprofit. One looks at creating a food incubator in the Sacramento region, so try to help new food businesses getting out off the ground, trying to really incentivize new entrepreneur-minded people interested in food businesses, potentially with limited resources, to get their business off the ground. The other one is creating a local food system in Solano County. So those are the two projects that we worked on. And so let me focus on Solano County. Solano County has...
Which is between Sacramento and San Francisco.
Yes. It has quite a bit of food production. Very little of what they're producing in their food stays within the county. So a lot of it gets shipped outside of the county, and a lot of the value gets added actually outside of the county. And so the idea there was really to try to keep some of the food within county and market the food as local. And in their idea, it was really local as from coming from the county. And so now if you are a small producer there, how would you do that? And so we identified that there wasn't quite a lot of willingness to pay for local within this county yet. So if you restrict the food producers or the farmers in this county to marketing their food as local as within the mile radius, you would essentially restrict the access to, for instance, the market in the Bay Area or in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. If you instead create a strong local brand like Solano Grown, what now happens is that the farmers and the food businesses can start promoting that brand within the county, but they can also use that brand to sell at the farmers market in San Francisco. It can be in the restaurants, and it can create awareness. And it does two things. It allows the farmers direct access to the markets that already have a high willingness to pay, create a visible brand, and provide ways to start advocacy and create an awareness and willingness to pay within their county. And this is where restaurants come in. The way to create this awareness is, again, trying to utilize economies of scale. And so rather than going to the consumer directly that might not have that willingness to pay yet, work with some of the institutions and potentially some of the restaurants. Because
like hospitals and schools?
Like hospitals and schools. And so data, and similar to restaurants, can highlight that some of the ingredients they use, some of the produce comes from within the county. And that incentivizes the consumer to have a higher appreciation and willingness to pay. While at the same time, the farmers are not restricted to just sell this in the county. They can use this brand. And as this brand establishes and has good quality attributes to get higher prices in the Bay Area, get higher prices in Sacramento. So you're not limiting their opportunities. You're actually opening.
That is really an interesting perspective, because I want to start back on that something you said, that so much of this demand is in large urban areas. And around the country right now, you know, whether you go to Austin or Kansas City or Des Moines or Pittsburgh or Cincinnati or Atlanta or Chattanooga, the cities all have some farm-to-fork restaurants. Say all are getting nice coffee roasters going that are independent coffee roasters. They have their share of millennials and hipsters.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if there is a single area of, say, a million or so population, which there must be three dozen or four dozen of those kind of metro areas across the United States. I don't know if there's a single one of them that doesn't have this either demand for local, organic, authentic, artisan. It's pretty much taking place across the board. But you're identifying an interesting problem, is that where it's grown sometimes, they don't, for various reasons. I don't know if it's just not it's not getting marketed there, but that's a surprising frontier, I guess.
Yes. Our explanation, and again, it's not necessarily our focus of research, but in terms of the background, the way it makes sense, I think, is this concept that I mentioned, that promoting local foods is really relationship marketing. And so if you think the way the urban consumer lives, the urban consumer might be more in need of this connection and community than some of the consumers in rural areas. In rural areas, the consumer might not necessarily use food as an expression of community or finding community. And so in that sense, it makes a lot more sense that the value for authenticity for food is higher in some of these urban areas than it would be in the rural areas. So there is more need of knowing where your food comes from, more need of having all this emotional connection with food, because the urban consumer is more removed from food production than some of the rural consumers.
You know, on the other hand, there still are areas that can specialize. And, for example, if you're going to have almonds, they're going to come from California. There's some other products, though, that they get from around the country. I've got a bias towards, I like fresh lamb from Colorado in October. You know, and so there are products that are different spots around the world that you can say, okay, I can get this. How does that fit into looking at local and authentic, that still understanding or appreciating Parmesan cheese, you know, which comes from Parma in northern Italy?
So that's, again, the idea of looking at the geographic identifiers that are used in Europe. And so your Parma cheese, Parmesan cheese, or any other aspects, if you think about champagne, they are now strengthened by some of the regulations we see. And the idea is, if you have these regional brands, it gives you the community benefit. It allows the farmers to brand their products specific to the region. But contrary to having it as a local definition where it is around mile radius, it doesn't limit the way that the products could be traded and sold. It expands the market. So then we will have an appreciation for Parmesan cheese, or we will have an appreciation for champagne. And so we will potentially pay a lot more than some of the consumers in that region. And so that, again, ensures the sustainability of that region and that they are getting credit for what they're doing and investing in the region. So it gives a broader perspective to this idea of preserving the authenticity of that local region, preserving agriculture and the value of agriculture you put in without limiting the opportunities. So local is sometimes criticized for this idea that it's like a, it's almost like a trade restriction or protectionism, right? But a regional brand wouldn't necessarily do that. It would allow you to value the diversity in your choices and would allow you to know where your food is coming from and build that idea of trust.
That's really, really, really interesting. And I think one other thing I just want to mention, though, too, in this whole marketing area, these are positive things. You mentioned geographic, you mentioned the local, the trust of who of farming practices in the various areas and that people come to believe. But there's also this advertising trend of people that say, for example, non-GMO is the best example. Non-GMO, no antibiotics, no hormones, all the absence of things that are being marketed, but they're being marketed on products that never had those products. I mean,
yes.
There are products that are identified as non-GMO, and somebody said, oh, good, it's non-GMO. You can't buy any GMO in those products. We've got like 8 products out of 350 produce that have any genetic engineering.
Yeah.
And if you're concerned about it, but still that's something that's working. And the same thing, they're putting on some products that hormone-free. Well, you couldn't possibly find anything hormone-free.
Yes.
So how distracting, how much is those kinds of tactics leading to us having less trust in the consumers? And maybe in another way, that brings you more towards trusting the one you can look in the eye.
So these are some of the fascinating aspects that I'm trying to explore a little bit more with my research and the idea of where our preferences come from and how we form them. For instance, for GMO, how do we create our preference for genetically or not genetically modified? For GMO, for instance, we find that consumers are a lot more suspicious for GMO than scientists are, for instance. So we have a lot of beliefs and emotions in some of those, and facts, presenting facts, doesn't necessarily change the opinion there. Mm-hmm. And as you say, and as I mentioned, with these credence attributes, we have a lot of information and symmetries, right? Somebody knows a lot more, and in that sense, the producer and the retailer and the manufacturers knows more, and they will take advantage of the preferences that the consumers have to promote their products. And so it leaves room for potentially misleading or at least not completely trustworthy marketing that can change the opinion. Like you say, like trans fats is another example where you have products labeled as no trans fats, or you have candy labeled as a non-fat food in the health context. I did a study on nutrition labeling. And so the idea is that that's where regulation sometimes can help. If we better understand consumer preferences and we understand the market structures and the strategic behavior, we can reinforce some of the incentives that the firm have and through the regulation ensure that the consumers get correct information and make choices that are ultimately better in the sense of healthier and more sustainable, but don't potentially mislead in all of those different directions. It's a fascinating topic. I love food labels and read them all the time.
We'll have to have another conversation on that sometime too, because now there's QR codes on a lot of labels, because you can have a virtual encyclopedia of information that's available if you wanted to go chase it back. And I still am kind of looking forward to that day that you can pick up any product and see the picture of the farmer or have him talk to you as you're on your way home.
Since you mentioned that is where my consumer research and marketing really overlaps. So what we find for consumers is that ideally consumers want to know everything there is to know about their food, right? And that is a challenge for the producer, because also consumers want very simple messages. So what we find with QR codes, for instance, is that, yes, it might be that consumers want the QR code on the products, but rarely ever do consumers then go and look at this information. Yeah. So it's, again, almost like an insurance Like, you want to know that it's there and that's documented, but then the producer still needs to figure out what is the characteristic that I need to communicate to get to the consumer. So I work quite a bit with manufacturers and producers, and that's one of the aspects that we address in our local study, but also in other studies, is of all the labels that are on the product, what are the labels that the consumers pay attention to, right? For instance, when you have a local label, does it then matter that you also have an organic label? Is local, to a certain extent, a substitute to organic, or do they reinforce each other? Because when we pick up a product nowadays, there isn't usually just one label. There's all these different things, from GMO to organic to vegan, what have you. And what is a challenge for the producers? How do I position and market my product so I tell the consumer what they really want to know?
And they have to be listening. And as you were saying that, I was just thinking, imagining that, say, something was on the market, organic artichokes from North Korea. You might pause if you were saying, I'm not so sure I could count on having organic production in North Korea. We could pick other countries that aren't as ridiculous as that example. But then that gets back to local or someone that they trust, or the reputation of the company, yeah, the reputation of the co-op, the reputation of reputations. I mean, change this whole marketing approach. When you look ahead, you are seeing students that are interested in this as well. You're doing research like this. What do you get excited about if you're looking over these next several years that you're anxious to dig into? And something you may see on the horizon that you're looking forward to addressing further?
There's a lot of different areas that I'm excited about, since you mentioned organic and organic products that come from other countries and different standards. We are really looking into new opportunities in the transition period. So in the US, for organic certification, you have a 3-year transition period. And so we are looking at opportunities to potentially label some of those products to give the producers that transition access to a higher margin and incentivize more transition. Because right now, U.S. production of organic is not growing as fast as consumer demand. And that means that we're having a lot of exports, which potentially other standards. And again, consumers might not exactly get what they think they're getting. What I'm looking forward and get excited for me personally is getting a better understanding and handle how we make, how we form our preference and how we can influence those preferences, right? How can we effectively inform consumers to make truly healthier choices, address issues like the obesity epidemic, address some of the environmental aspect of food production. Kind of from a student perspective, I'm really looking forward to get students excited about the opportunities and challenges in agriculture and the food industry, to communicate, even in our students that, as you say, are going to a college that is the number one college in agriculture. A lot of our students are not necessarily interested in jobs in agriculture or the food industry. And really getting them excited about the opportunities in this industry going forward that include technology, that include environmental issues, and that include the pure pleasure of food that can...
Well, I tell you, you're getting me excited about these directions, and I'm always excited about the pleasure of food. Too much, I'm afraid. And if other people are getting excited and they're interested in this direction, where should they look to find your papers or your research or know more of what's going on in this direction?
There's lots of avenues to look at. There is some, the article that you are referencing comes from a publication that is a publication of our department here at UC Davis, Agriculture and Resource Economics, and the Agriculture and Resource Economics Department in Berkeley. It's called AIE Update. It tries to break down some of our research so that it's more accessible. You can get it from the Giannini Foundation, on the Giannini Foundation website. I guess I'm going to do this the old-fashioned way and read the address, https://giannini.ucop.edu. You can also just go to my website and find some of this information. When it comes to food, we have a lot of different mainstream outlets. And then, of course, there is the underlying research there as well. So there's a lot of ways to get more information and get informed. There's more information out there than you have time to read it all.
Oh, there's more to talk about. We'll do it again. And I really appreciate Kristen Kiesel of UC Davis being with me on Farm to Table Talk. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.